Welcome to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee meeting for Wednesday, February 1st. I appreciate members' presence. We do have some additional members who are here, but they're not here. They're here, but they're not at the table. And we want to get started out of respect for our guests and witnesses. And we have three things on the agenda today. Briefly, we wanted to have an update on an inspection issue that was raised last year, just to kind of revisit that to see where we are. And then we've got from the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services some information presented to the committee on the insurance reform task force that's been working over the interim, and then some information on the implementation of the defined contribution program that was part of our budget bill that was passed last session. So I'd like to invite the commissioner or his representatives to take up the first topic. Commissioner Ellinger, welcome to our committee. And I guess just for review, members, last year, one of the first meetings we had when the commissioner came and talked a little bit about what the department was charged with to do, and one of the things that the department does is provide inspections for various medical facilities. And this was right shortly after what happened in Philadelphia, where there was a tragic clinic providing abortions, I believe, in Philadelphia, and it was just a horror. And we had not been caught in whatever inspection regimen. And so we had a little discussion about that and asked the commissioner if he would be willing to provide the committee with some information about what we do and the status of inspections of abortion providers in Minnesota, just so that we can be assured that there are not similar things going on in Minnesota. And so I'd asked the commissioner or his staff to come this morning just to give us a little update on where that is, and turn it over to you, Commissioner, to give us an update on that issue. Thank you.
Chairman Hamm, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health for the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here to respond to the series of questions that Chairman Hamm submitted to us pertaining to the inspection of medical clinics where abortion services are performed in the state of Minnesota. And I appreciate the opportunity to present this information to you this morning. I'm sorry we didn't respond to your response earlier. I thought we had done that, but please accept my apologies for that. I'm joined at the table with my Deputy Commissioner Jim Koppel, who will later present some of the summary data that we have from our existing mandating reports about abortion services in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, you've asked me to address the following questions. Which facilities have been inspected in the last year, and which ones have not been inspected? When did the inspections take place, and who performed the inspections? But before responding directly to those questions, I want to give you a little bit of background about how oversight of medical clinics and hospitals in the state occurs. It's a general framework that we use in our state to ensure that there's high-quality care. It is a multi-layered approach. Healthcare facilities are regulated and overseen not only by governmental entities like the Minnesota Department of Health, which I will talk about in a minute, but also by a broad assortment of other organizations like the Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals, the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, which provides oversight to ambulatory clinics, the various medical specialty boards, and for physicians and nurses and pharmacists and other providers, the National Committee on Quality Assurance for Health Plans, and then various other professional organizations that provide standards and oversights to the clinics and services that are provided related to their activities. So thus, healthcare regulation is clearly a compendium of governmental and private oversight. As an example, I want to look at particularly physician regulation, which I'm personally familiar with as a physician, and one of the oldest and most established regulatory systems in our country. The regulatory system for physician and the medical profession stems from the 1880s, where the AMA and professions really agreed that they are going to regulate their own members. The result is a system where physicians are licensed at the state level. But while physician licensure is at a state level and it operates on a state-by-state basis, there is a national practitioner database which stores information on the disciplinary actions of all physicians in the United States. In addition, Physicians are regulated by numerous other governmental and private entities. Everybody has to take a licensure exam in the state where they're going to be practiced, and that's done by the private groups. Medical schools are accredited by private entities. Certification of specialists is done by the various boards of practice where they have specific expertise. For example, I'm boarded in internal medicine and pediatrics and had to have additional training and follow up with testing by those two boards. And once licensed by their medical licensure board, physicians are also credentialed by payers like Medicare and Medicaid, insurance companies, health plans, and also credentialed by the hospitals where they seek privileges to practice. In addition, in Minnesota, the quality of care in clinics is evaluated by the Minnesota Community Measurement Program and by provider peer grouping tools that have been established and administered by the Minnesota Department of Health. So physicians are highly regulated in their practice, and for good reason. The special relationship between a physician, provider, and his or her patient is special and needs to be recognized and maintained that quality. Because our current regulatory system for clinics and hospitals is rooted in that American Medical Association provider-based licensing system, which was established over 100 years ago, I felt that it was important to provide some of that history of physician regulation prior to responding to your specific questions about our clinic inspections. So moving on to the clinic and hospital regulations. Physician clinics are regulated first by an umbrella of physician licensure rules promulgated by the Board of Medical Practice that I just outlined. In addition, clinics and hospitals are inspected and regulated by numerous governmental entities for a variety of clinical quality and structural physical issues, including from the state level, X-ray and radiation, where there is X-ray department, or we look for radiation issues, bed licensing, Board of Pharmacy inspects the pharmacies, and as I said, the Board of Medical Practice, the Board of Nursing, the Board of Pharmacy looks at the quality of care oversight and responding to any complaints that comes from the people in those various professions. The federal government and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services do things like the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act, or CLIA, so they inspect the laboratories in hospitals and clinics. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, to make sure that we're protecting data privacy. Occupational Health and Safety, or OSHA. And then there are local agencies that get involved in assuring health and safety with local building codes and fire codes that are overseen at the local level. And then there are non-governmental agencies like the Joint Commission for Hospitals, the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare for Clinics, and various other private organizations that oversee that. So therefore, Mr. Chair, there isn't one specific entity that inspects clinics and hospitals in Minnesota. So in response to your first question, which facilities have been inspected in the last year and which facilities have not, the Minnesota clinics and hospitals are regulated on an ongoing basis by the Minnesota Department of Health, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, private accrediting agencies, and Health Licensing Board. MDH's specific responsibility is to inspect licensed hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers, long-term care facilities, and nursing homes. The Minnesota Department of Health does not have the responsibility to license or inspect medical clinics. However, if a problem is reported to the Minnesota Department of Health, it is referred to the appropriate oversight committee. So your second question, you know, so when did the inspections take place? Again, as I outlined, the Minnesota Department of Health does not have the responsibility for inspecting medical clinics in the state of Minnesota. And so therefore, for the third question, who performed those inspections, since MDH does not have the responsibility for oversight, responsibility for inspecting medical clinics in the state of Minnesota. So in closure, Mr. Chairman, I want to reiterate, Minnesota has a regulatory system for clinics and hospitals that is rooted in the licensure and practice of individual health care providers. Their oversight is supplemented by a number of federal, state, and private accrediting authorities with their rules and regulations. I will now turn it over to my Deputy Commissioner Jim Koppel, who will give you some information about some of the mandatory reporting that we do have related to various clinics who provide abortion services.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I just to be make it clear for me that with respect to there's variety kinds of medical clinics that we have. I visited a clinic several months ago out in Bloomington where they performed lens replacement cataract surgery. Took about 15 minutes. It was pretty interesting. Actually, they let me observe one. But as a clinic, is then that would not fall under your jurisdiction as some entity that you would be inspecting or trying to just verify that what they're doing is the right thing? Is that true?
Mr. Chair, we have responsibility for licensing and inspecting hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers. And my understanding of where you would have gone probably would have been to an ambulatory surgical center where the sole thing that they do is provide surgical procedures to pre-diagnosed conditions. So they don't do any other service other than the surgical service. And we do have some responsibility for inspecting those ambulatory surgical centers.
Something like, is LASIK considered, clinics that deal with LASIK, would that also be considered an ambulatory surgery center? Or that, I guess I'm trying to get at is what is the distinction between a clinic and a surgery center? Is that something that, you can help us with?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, A ambulatory surgical center is where only surgical procedures are done on pre-diagnosed conditions where there is no ongoing care related to that. It's to a surgical procedure that is pre-diagnosed, whereas clinics really are taking care, we take care of a whole range of services, do the diagnostic and some of the therapeutic activities. And it's that is under the license of the physician or who's responsible for that clinic.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm assuming that LASIK is part of that ambulatory surgical clinic where you went.
And one other question that this came up, we had a discussion earlier a few days ago, but dental clinics that may perform tooth extraction that would require somebody to be put under a general anesthetic, would that fall in the category of a clinic or a surgery center?
Mr. Chair, dental clinics are considered clinics. They're not considered surgical centers, so they fall under the same kind of rubric that medical clinics would be following. And in addition, even if they are doing some anesthetic care.
Okay. Thank you. And then if you would, wouldn't mind just introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Jim Koppel, the Deputy Commissioner for Minnesota Department of Health. And I'll be very brief to allow for any other questioning, but I just wanted to go over the current reporting process in Minnesota specific to abortions, and that every physician in Minnesota annually receives a two-page reporting form to report any and every abortion they perform. That report, those reports are tracked by us, and then we put out annually and this you may have seen we're mandated to put out a report which lists all of those and a lot of other additional information under various categories, etc. The majority of 95% of abortions take place in clinics, about 5% are in hospitals, and there are a very limited number of clinics that perform those. And that's the gist of it.
And I, as Mr. Koppel, as you and I discussed a little bit at another meeting, to the extent that there would be problems similar to what occurred out in Philadelphia, how would those problems be discovered? Would there be any normal process if something like that was going on, that, or would that sort of rely on somebody reporting or making a complaint or something?
It would, Mr. Chairman, it would be a complaint system where if someone called us with a complaint about a clinic, we would refer them on to the, if it's a physician, we would refer them on to the Board of Medicine where it has oversight over that, and they would follow up. They have their Ethical Practices Committee and other groups that, you know, would take any disciplinary actions or whatever actions were necessary.
So if the general question were asked in Minnesota, whatever the number of clinics that we have that perform these procedures, that that there is nothing similar to what happened in Philadelphia in existence in Minnesota, would you feel comfortable in saying with certainty or with assurance that, that the public can be assured that those conditions don't exist?
Mr. Chair, I believe that, as I outlined, we have several layers of oversight of all of the medical practices that occur in the state. You know, Some of them are licensing, some of our regulatory, some of them are through the Board of Medical Practice, the Board of Nursing, the Board of Pharmacy. I believe that we have a system that really helps us assure that we get high-quality care to everybody in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, I thank you for your willingness to come and give us an update on that question. I appreciate it very much, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Next, we'd like to hear from Commissioner Jessen and or her representatives. We've got two pieces of information that we're hoping to get some information on, the first being the update or information about the Health Insurance Reform Task Force that's been working over the interim. And welcome, Commissioner Jessen.
Senator Hand, could I interject one thing? I'm reading the agenda here, and I see, you know, I was at a presentation, Commissioner, you gave, and you started out with, it was about the health insurance exchanges, and you started out with a statement that I am not the Commissioner of Commerce. And here on our agenda, it says that you are the Commissioner of Commerce.
Senator Lurie, I'm glad you pointed that out.
So I'm just wondering where we're going to go with this line of questioning today.
Senator Lurie, I'm glad you pointed that out. We were going to designate Commissioner Jessen to have a dual. No, I apologize. That's my fault. We made a mistake. So it is the Commissioner of Health and Human Services.
Oh,
thank
good.
You for
okay,
pointing
good.
That out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Just so I could have some clarification, Mr. Chair, I thought the agenda item was that you were asking for an update of the work of the Minnesota Healthcare Reform Task Force, which is what I was prepared to talk about, you know, this morning.
Commissioner, you're correct, and we probably have that mistitled on our. So we've got some reform work we need to do on our agenda. So the Healthcare Reform Task Force, and you are the Commissioner of Department of Human Services. So we'll note that for future reference. Thank you.
But certainly, Mr. Chair, I am an ex officio member of the Exchange Advisory Task Force. So if there are questions about that, you know, I'm certainly not that I can't answer, I will. But if I'm happy to be here to update you on the work of the Minnesota Healthcare Reform Task Force. As you know, we have a really strong history in Minnesota of working across party lines and with advocates, health plans, and providers to all collaborating to pass historic legislation. In the 1970s, we passed MSHA, which is now the nation's largest high-risk pool. We're the first state to do that. In the 1980s, we enacted the first special health insurance program for children, which became a model for the nation. In the 1990s, it was Minnesota Care, and under Governor Pawlenty, we passed QCARE, adverse event reporting, and really the historic 2008 reforms, which included healthcare homes, statewide quality reporting, and provider peer grouping. And the healthcare reform task force that I'm chairing, that started meeting in November, really, I believe, will help Minnesota keep our place, kind of build upon those previous reforms, and continue to focus on the triple aim, which is better healthcare, lower costs, and healthier communities. And we know we need to address all those issues in order to move forward in healthcare. So I thought I would just at least provide a little information on the makeup of the committee and some of our current work and our goals and kind of on what we're trying to achieve. So the task force members were appointed based upon a session law that was passed in 2010, and I believe there's a handout that you all have that talks about that session law, as well as the governor's executive order, 1130. I'm really delighted to be chair of the task force and to sit at the table with members who bring expertise from across our state, and really, I think, represent the full continuum of services that keep Minnesotans healthy, from acute care to long-term care, mental health and disability services, as well as public health. And I think really the strength of this task force is in the diversity of perspectives that are represented in our discussions. The 17-member task force includes four members of the legislature, including Senators Benson and Nienau, who are here. And I'm sure if I misstate anything, they will be willing to jump in and correct or modify. But it also includes the Commissioners of Health and Commerce and just a number of private sector representatives. Their names are on your handout, but it's just, I think, if you take a look at those, people like Mary Brainerd, Jan Malcolm, Dr. Doug Wood, Dr. Therese Zink, I mean, and others. I'm not trying to leave anyone out, but I think you'll see from the membership that we have a real brain trust at the table. And I just want to publicly thank all of the members for their work on these complex issues. The task force will provide the governor and the legislature with a set of recommendations by the end of November of 2012. We're calling this a roadmap to a healthier Minnesota, and it will include policy recommendations that we believe will keep Minnesota moving forward on meeting the triple aim. We started meeting in late November, and there have been a few key themes that have come up even in our first few meetings. So let me just quickly tell you what those are. One, that the purpose of health reform should be to maximize health and functioning for all Minnesotans, but to do it at a cost that is sustainable for our economy. That we need to do a better job of serving Minnesotans who move between our care systems. We have too many silos, and we lose people. They aren't as healthy when they go from one silo from another, from our mental health silo to our acute care, from our acute care system to our long-term care system. And this is going to become even more important as the number of older Minnesotans increases in the decades to come. I think a third thing we agreed upon is that we need to engage consumers in a meaningful way in their health care decisions. Everything from choosing a health plan that works for them to knowing when they should be using the emergency room to what they need to do to appropriately stay healthy. So we need to engage them. We need all Minnesotans to have affordable and portable health care coverage and accessible services at predictable costs. And finally, that prevention of avoidable health problems should be central. You know, these concepts have the support of the entire task force, and I think they really demonstrate how much common ground there really is for us to work from. You know, in order to have more in-depth conversations with stakeholder organizations on these issues, we've organized our efforts into four work groups. I think there's a website that, you know, is on your materials, which can, you know, point you to a place where you can go and find out more. But if it's okay, I'll just at least briefly highlight some of the first things that those work groups are working on. First, we have the Access Work Group. And that's focused on issues that ensure that Minnesotans are engaged healthcare consumers, that they have access to affordable coverage, and that they can easily get information about what their options are. So this group is looking at the healthcare safety net, the issue of essential health benefits, how to ensure that eligibility and enrollment in our public programs is streamlined and user-friendly. They're providing input on exchange-related activities and leading discussions on the issues, an issue that Minnesota has to consider this year, which is the essential health benefits. And maybe if I could say a few words, Mr. Chair, about that issue. Essential health benefits are those benefits that the ACA says have to be covered starting in 2014 in the exchange and in new plans. In the Affordable Care Act, they set out here are the 10, you know, services, and they really left that must be included things like ambulatory patient services, emergency services, hospitalizations, pretty much the basics. And they left it to HHS really to kind of fill in the blanks. In December, the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level informed states that the essential health benefits for plan years 2014 and 2015 will be state-based, that states will have to select a benchmark plan. Now, I must say that while I think the federal government has done a good job on guidance in a lot of ways, I think they missed the mark here. It's my personal opinion, but no one asked me to run the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level. I am all for state flexibility, but I thought that actually this would have been a good time to look at what should be in our essential benefit set and to have a conversation around that. But instead, states get to select from the following options. The state's largest plan by enrollment, you know, amongst the small group market, basically. Any of the state employee health benefit plans, or one of the three largest federal employee health plans, you know, options, or the largest insured commercial non-Medicaid HMO operating in the states. What the access work group has spent some time doing is really trying to, and we've worked, I think, pretty well with we've gotten information from the health plans. They've been helpful to us to say, okay, here are, you know, the products, here's what they cover, so that we know what products fall into each of those four categories. And we're really just trying to sort through that, right now. It's important to note, though, that if Minnesota doesn't actively select a benchmark by the third quarter of this year, and I think most of you are aware of this, then the small group plan will become the benchmark. Now, that benchmark applies only for the plan years 2014 and 2015, so it doesn't preclude a robust discussion that I was referring to earlier about mandated benefits in the future, but that's the reality of where we are on essential benefits. Another matter that the access group is looking at is what will Minnesota Care look like in 2014 and beyond? And, of course, I know that this is important to many, if not all of you as well, but that is certainly something that we want to be in the position to at least give you the best thinking of this task force, by the end of November. The Medicaid expansion under the federal law and the subsidized private coverage in the exchange, they're going to provide new options, coverage options for Minnesotans that are currently on Minnesota Care. So what this work group is looking at, and we'll make recommendations to the full task force about, is, how do we best provide the coverage to make the best use of state dollars, to provide stable coverage? We're so blessed in many ways here in Minnesota. We are so ahead of the game, ahead of where most states are. So in most states, they would just look at the federal government coming in and saying, okay, we're going to people above 133% of the poverty level and above, now they have access, to some subsidies, at least, depending on their income, to buy coverage in the exchange. They didn't have state programs like Minnesota Care. They didn't have things already in place to help some of those populations. So we need to take a hard look at that and figure out what's the best way to design this going forward, taking advantages of things from the federal government that fit with where we want to go as a state, but making our own choices. One thing we have to consider there is the option that's available under the federal law to create a basic health plan. The basic health plan option, basically, is that states can say to the federal government, okay, give us 95% of the value of these subsidies, because remember, the federal government will provide subsidies to buy insurance for people between 133% and 200% of the poverty level. Give us 95% of that and let us do it ourselves. Well, we'd have to provide to cover at least same number of people and with at least the same benefits. And I think there's some questions. There's some opportunities with that, and there's some real questions about that option as well. I think that this is something that we certainly will spend some good amount of time studying, because there's some pros and cons to a basic health plan. I think many of us acknowledge the need for continuity. We don't want people just sliding, now you're on Medicaid, now you're on a private program, going and losing coverage where they just once again end up in our emergency rooms. But is the basic health plan the best way to do that? Is there some other mechanism? So that's something that this work group will be looking at and then once again taking to the full task force. A second work group that's gotten off to a quick start already, and I know, Senator Nienau, you're on that work group, is the Care Integration and Payment Reform Work Group. I think most of you all know that we in Minnesota have been at the forefront of innovative care and payment models, and this work group is looking at opportunities to accelerate those innovations. For example, this work group is examining where we are with healthcare homes. That we're begun with our 2008 bipartisan legislation. And that's one of those things that the federal government then looked at and said, well, that was a good idea, Minnesota. We should try that around the country. But I think this work group is looking at, well, where are we? How are we doing? What's working well in this model? What needs to change? Where do we need to adjust? How can we build upon this or make corrections where we need to? Another thing they're looking at is how we create new payment models. Once again, I think we're at Minnesota is at the forefront of trying to move away from paying providers on a fee-for-service basis and instead trying to create incentives for providers to keep patients healthy We've been doing this a lot in the private sector in Minnesota. You know, accountable care organizations is kind of this new term that people put to this, but I think it's, you know, building on something that has been started, been going on for a few years here in Minnesota. And that's where we're trying to tie part of the payment to providers to achieving efficiencies and quality outcomes, and basically saying, look, if we project that this is what it would cost, you know, if we just kept going the same way we're going to care for this population of payments, if you provide, you know, care to that population and you meet our quality measures and you achieve some savings, let's share that savings. It's basically a shared savings model. I think trying to move towards a model where we're paying providers to keep people healthy instead of just paying for a test, for a procedure, in a fee-for-service way. So it's, I think, trying. So those are some of the just concepts this group is talking about. And I think one of the things that's a testament to how much we are already ahead of the game in this is that the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services have, when they announced what they called their 32 pioneer ACOs, 32 across the country, three of those are in the Twin Cities. So I think that while we're ahead, we want to continue to push the edge of that envelope. And this is a group that's talking about how, you know, what should we as a state be doing in order to accelerate those innovations. Acute care and long-term care integration is also something they're looking at. How do we better integrate those systems so that we do a better job as Minnesotans move from hospitals to nursing homes or home care, you know, to both, once again, save money and improve care. The third group is the workforce work group, and this work group is identifying opportunities to ensure that we have a sufficient healthcare workforce statewide, including primary care, mental health, chemical health, dental, and long-term care. I think we have real challenges in Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota, in this regard. So their work plan includes looking at opportunities that fall basically in three main areas. Workforce supply and quality of life issues, which looks at the requirements and costs of training our healthcare workforce, looking at whether we're paying providers commensurate with their contributions to health, what do we need to do to retain the providers that we need. They're going to be talking about models that maximize the workforce that we have, such as the advanced practice registered nurses. They're looking at technology. You know, are there creative options for how telemedicine and other technologies can extend the reach of our current healthcare workforce? How do we best make use of the providers that we have? How do we cross-train and encourage providers to practice at the top of their license? So that's some of the things that the workforce group is looking at. We also have a prevention and public health work group. This work group is meeting this Friday for the first time, and they're going to really take a first look at the statewide health assessment that's being developed by the Department of Health. But since they're just starting to meet this week, because they wanted to wait for that assessment to be completed as a starting off place, I'm not going to talk much about them. I don't want to prejudge what they'll be talking about. I do know that there have been mentioned to me they want to look at, for example, workplace wellness and how we can encourage more of that in our state. You know, in his executive order, the governor directed the task force to engage communities and consumers in health reform. And while we had a practice of having part of our meetings, you know, available for public comment, and we are going to have three of our meetings this summer in greater Minnesota, we thought we wanted to do more than that. And I'm really delighted that the Bush Foundation has taken a leadership role together with help from the Blandin Foundation and the Minneapolis Foundation to generally support this work. So they are supporting a nonpartisan consumer and business engagement plan with the Citizens League that will bring together Minnesotans across the state in a dialogue to give advice and input to the task force on their perspective, from a family perspective, from a local business perspective, about what we should be doing to have better care, lower costs, and healthier communities. The Citizens League's in a planning stages now. They're going to begin statewide meetings in March, and they will be providing regular updates to the committee, and I want to thank them and the foundations as well for their work. I think, Mr. Chair, you have in your packets kind of a tentative schedule for our meetings and, like, when the work groups will be giving, you know, initial recommendations to the task force, you know, where the task forces will be. You know, this is just a work in progress, as so many things are. But I think you'll see that we do have a lot going on. But I think that these efforts have a broad base of support and engagement. And I'm really very hopeful that later this year we'll be able to bring you some concrete recommendations on how to keep Minnesota on a path for better health for all Minnesotans and to maintain our spot as a real national health care leader.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I do want to open this up for questions. I think Senator Rosen, you had a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Commissioner Jessen. Very nice to see you. And I have very high hopes on this health care reform project. And I was part of the health care reform in 08 with Senator Berglund. We worked a long time. And my question is, how much of the 08 health care reform, you mentioned a little bit about the accountable care reform, the shared savings. Is there other pieces of that reform that you are building off of or that you've had to go back and adjust? Or, you know, that's one part of the question. And number two, to me, it seems like Minnesota has set a very strong example for the feds to look at. And if you're getting feedback from the feds, CMS, about what we have been doing, what we need to adjust going forward. So several questions there, but basing it off of the 08 health care reform, which was monumental. That was it did adjust things accordingly.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I couldn't agree more. The work that was done in 2008 that was just a great leap forward towards health reform. And actually, in our first meeting, what we did was that we gave the report to all of our current members of our task force and started out with actually a summary, both of what those recommendations were, what passed in 2008, and we also heard about how that task force functioned. You know, because, you know, my understanding was they worked very well together. I actually even followed up and had, had lunch with, then Commissioner Ludeman to ask him for his advice because it seemed that he and Representative Huntley chaired that. It seemed like they made a lot of progress. So we really, truly started there because I see this as building off of those reforms. You know, and I, as far as your question about our input, Senator Rosen from CMS, you know, Overall, especially on the payment reform models that we're looking at both in the private sector here in Minnesota, you know, and some of the things we're doing at the Department of Human Services on these demonstration projects to try and do direct contracting with providers, we've gotten excellent feedback, and they're encouraging us to go out, do more, do quicker. So I'm very encouraged by the feedback we've gotten.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Commissioner. And to the question, is there anything in the 08 health care reform that we need to adjust that is not, it's dragging its feet or it's just not going to work? Because that was a very good working group, and we worked a long time. So I'm very glad to hear that you sought out good advice, and it was a bipartisan group, too.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen. As far as what might need to be adjusted from the 2008 work, I just, you know, that hasn't come concretely before the whole task force, and I just wouldn't want to prejudge that. But that certainly is one of the things we will be looking at.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there other questions from committee members? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I'm going to ask a question I asked Commissioner Rothman yesterday, and we were kind of pressed for time, and I didn't, at least for me, didn't get a very helpful answer. And since you're on the exchange task force, maybe you can give us some insight. The last question that I had for Commissioner Rothman was regarding the risk rates and the proposal. We can go with the federal or we can go with the state, and the proposal was go with the state to try to get some state-specific benefits and leverage that. And my question was, what might some of those state-specific opportunities, I think was the word, that was in the report, what might some of those be, and how do we, I believe ACA requires an individualized rate, and how do we do that?
Commissioner?
And how do we get to that point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, Senator, while I am an ex officio member of that task force, you know, my involvement in the task force was much more. I went to the governance work group meetings more than I did the risk adjustments. So while I'm, you know, generally familiar with it, you're asking me a question that is calls for a level of expertise I don't have sitting here. But I would say, if I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Nenow, I believe Commissioner Rothman is going to be updating our task force at our next meeting. So that would be, I think, a really good question to ask him.
Thank you. Commissioner, just I had a question earlier in your presentation. You were talking a little bit about the essential benefit discussion, and I don't want to prejudge the work of the committee, and certainly not asking you to do so, but maybe you can clarify. My understanding was your comments were suggesting that there were sort of 10 general areas that essential benefits need to address, but the specifics, I guess at one point there was a thought that the federal government was going to be specific, and then they changed their mind and said no, and they gave us some options. Is it your thought that this task force would make a recommendation in time for the legislature to enact in law an essential benefit set? Is that sort of your thought? And if so, what's your timing roughly on that?
Mr. Chair, originally it was my hope that this access work group would be able to get information in time to make a recommendation to the full task force at our early February meeting. I think just because of delay in getting complete information about what these four options are and would mean, I think that we'll be educating the task force. I don't think we'll know enough and have gotten enough of the concrete information to be able to make a recommendation. So we'll have that discussion in February. It would be my hope that at least in the early March meeting, but I don't know that that's in time, that we'd be able to at least, you know, make a recommendation to the legislature. But I think that would depend, you know, once again, on a vote and what, you know, motions we get in the task force. But that would be, you know, at least we'll have the information in front of them so that they could make a recommendation.
Well, I appreciate that. And I guess I'm just asking, given the way you described it, it was if we didn't do something positively, then there was going to be sort of a default. And maybe at some point in the future you can update us on that to tell us if we don't do something, here is the default with some specificity. And I guess I would just encourage your work group to try to make some recommendations to the legislature in time for us to address that in the committee. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will certainly try to do that. And we are at the department trying to look and say, you know, and understand exactly what that default choice would be. Right. So obviously we're very willing to share that information anytime.
All right. Thank you. Are there other questions from committee members? All right. Thank you for your willingness to come this morning and talk a little bit about the health care reform task force, Commissioner. And if we could now just turn to the third item on our agenda, which, members, we had a provision in our last bill that probably a little controversial with respect to some changes in the Minnesota Care Program, specifically a segment of the upper income end of that, where we put in place in law a defined contribution structure. And given that that was a relatively new idea and some transition needs to be contemplated and pursued, I was hoping we could get a little bit of an update from the department on where they are in that work and how they see that progressing, and whether or not they feel that's progressing adequately. And so welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, as you mentioned, the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program was a program that was established by the 2011 legislature. And essentially what it does is to replace the existing Minnesota Care Program for enrollees who are adults without children, who have incomes at or above 200% of poverty and up to 250% of poverty. The way the system currently works is that those individuals, like all individuals on Minnesota Care, pay a monthly premium and receive a benefit set in exchange for that. That is administered by the Department of Human Services. The Healthy Contribution Program makes a change to that by, for those individuals above 200% of poverty, Instead of paying a monthly premium, as of July 1st of 2012, they instead will receive a monthly defined contribution to purchase coverage under a private health plan or through the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. Underwriting rules still apply to these individuals, so they're denied coverage in the individual market. On the private side, MCHA is an option for them as well. So the change here is that we're moving for those individuals from a program administered by the Department of Human Services to one where they are receiving a defined amount of money each month that's paid to the health plan that they choose to enroll in on the private market. Based on data that we have, approximately 3,500 people sort of fall into that category of being above 200% of poverty and being childless adults on the Minnesota Care Program. It is a program where the Minnesota Care eligibility requirements will still continue to apply. So everything that applies to Minnesota Care currently, they have to be uninsured for at least 4 months, not have access to employer-based coverage for at least 18 months. All those eligibility standards still apply. The means by which they're receiving their coverage under the program merely changes. The contribution that is made to the health plans on their behalf for the purchase of private coverage is calculated on a sliding scale, and that's based on income, and that's based on household on their age rather than the household income. That is statutorily defined. That's baked into the statute itself. And what the law also requires is that eligible applicants and enrollees must be referred to professional insurance agent associations or broker associations. Brokers play a very important role in the private market in helping to hook people up to available coverage in their area. And if I could say, Mr. Chair, that both the health plans and the agents have been extremely collaborative during this entire process. I think it's been a very smooth process. They've been very helpful in helping to get this program up and running. It does have, as I mentioned, an effective date of July 1st. We fully anticipate the program being functioning on that date. We're on target to meet that implementation. What will happen is that on July 1st, the individuals who are currently enrolled in Minnesota Care who meet the criteria of the law will no longer be eligible for the current Minnesota Care benefit set, and rather will have the opportunity to transition over. Obviously, they have to have some time to be able to know what their choices are, be able to go through the underwriting process at the plans. And so while the effective date is July 1st, there's a lot of work that has had to occur up to this point. And so we'll be doing notifications in the spring to those individuals, March or April, to ensure that they have adequate time to see what their options are, to be able to go through the underwriting process so that we can get them enrolled and not have a gap in coverage, which is what we're trying to avoid. This is a collaborative process between the Department of Human Services and the Commerce Department. We've met extensively with the broker associations, with health plans, and with the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association to discuss the implementation of this program. As I mentioned, it's been a very collaborative process. This is a new process for the department. We haven't administered a program like this before. And this is a new process for the plans. And I think the brokers are also dealing with a newer population. So for all of us, it's been a learning. And I think it's been a very helpful process to go through. Just I want to identify a few issues that we are working through. And again, Mr. Chair, we fully intend to have the program operational by July 1st. The first is the identification of policies that will be available on July 1st of 2012. There are certain criteria that need to be met that the law required that the policies have, including coverage for mental health and other provisions. And so we're working with the plans right now to identify which plans currently might exist that actually meet the criteria, and also to make them aware of what the criteria are. So if they choose to file a plan that would meet this criteria, they have time to do that. The second is to put in place a process by which we can provide educational information as well as referral information for Minnesota Care applicants and enrollees to help them in their selection of a private market plan for the individuals who meet this this healthy contribution program criteria. The brokers, again, have been very helpful. I think they're working as a coalition to set up a website. The department is also setting up a website that will refer them to that as well as provide options to them and information as to how they can go about enrolling. And so we're working with coalitions of people to try to get that up and running. And then finally, Mr. Chair, one of the issues here is to that we probably has taken the most amount of sort of technical time has been figuring out a system by which the department will transfer payments to the health plans for on behalf of the enrollees as they select a plan. Obviously, the individual needs to select a plan. We need to know what that plan is. We need to know what the cost of the plan is so that we can transfer the money to the plans. The plans have to know then what the amount that's being transferred and what the enrollee share is. And so there's a number of technical issues that we've been working through. I think that's been a good process. I think we've all learned a lot during that process about the about the different systems that we have in place. And that are the ones that we had currently in place just simply weren't set up to do this as they stood. And so the process that we've been going through has been really to work through all of those issues iteratively. And again, I think that's been a good process. And again, we fully anticipate that we will be able to get there from here by July 1st so that this program can be implemented.
Thank you, Mr. Lights. I appreciate your work and the work of the department. I understand that this is a challenging task and a new one, and appreciate very much your collaborative work, as you've indicated, and encouraging report that despite the change and the newness of this, that it seems to be progressing and the issues I've identified seem to have an expectation of being resolved in time to meet the effective date. Please, if you run into problems along the way, let us know, and just be happy to try to help in any way, but I appreciate the report. Are there any questions for members of the committee? Senator Sharon.
Would you remind me, please, thank you, Senator, in the legislation, as you design this and try to work through the initiatives that you have to in order to provide for the voucher to people under 200% or income above 200%, what is there anything in the legislation or anything that you're designing in this process that tells us what the outcome, what gain we are trying to accomplish with this and whether or not measures are implemented for us to know whether or not we're achieving what this effort is about?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, we certainly, one of the things that we will have in place is a mechanism by which we will monitor kind of what the uptake of individuals is into this new program. So it will be a change from what we're currently doing. And so some people will transfer from current Minnesota Care into a different looking benefit set that will be more private market like. One of the things that we'll want to know, I think everyone will want to know, is what that uptake is to ensure that people aren't slipping through the cracks and that we have some mechanisms by which we can, if they do, have some outreach to them to let them educate them with regards to their options. And so we certainly will be monitoring that. We'll be happy to report back to the committee what we learned during that transfer process.
Yes, sir. Sure.
Thank you for that. I think that that will certainly tell us who's using the system, but I don't know that that tells me has this improved our processes? Has the healthcare capacity of the voucher system done something better for us or not, and how has it impacted the because there is this ability still, as I understand what you said, for the private marketplace to refuse to take the very best and healthiest people and leave the iller people to the MCHA program. Are we in the process of developing this, also defining measures that tell us whether or not we are really creating an outcome that's good for the taxpayers, or if it simply is a benefit to the insurance companies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I think you raised very good points around making sure that we're not just measuring who falls off, but what also the outcomes that we're getting from those programs. And I think that's a very good point for us to take back and think about as we're implementing the program and how we actually can measure some of those things.
Thank you. I would appreciate that because those will be the questions I'll be asking.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. I agree with you. I think our intent in the course of developing the program and passing it, there was an understanding that there would be an opportunity we felt, believed, to not only save taxpayers' money but also provide a good outcome. And I share with you the same desire to do what we can to understand what happens. So as you think about those things, and if you have any information you'd like to bring to us, let us know. Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That kind of piqued my interest on the underwriting criteria. So I guess if you could just help me understand, we're in the process of changing the pre-existing condition criteria in the country. So as we think about its relationship to the defined benefit program, to the changing of pre-existing condition with respect to the underwriting criteria of the insurance companies and those that would normally go to IMCHA, could you walk us through that a little bit in your thinking as you've worked on this implementation?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, I'll do my best. I will try to capture as much as I can about that. When the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program passed, what wasn't passed along with that at the state level were any changes for those individuals who would be eligible for the program with regards to the underwriting status of them, meaning those individuals who will be moving to the private market with a contribution will be subject to whatever the current state of the world is with regards to underwriting. Now, in today's world, individual market, that means they can still be denied coverage if they have a pre-existing health condition. The bill did anticipate that and provided for a somewhat higher subsidy for individuals who were underwritten out of the market into the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association to make that coverage more affordable for them as they make that movement. You're right, as we move towards more full implementation of some of the federal pieces that require changes to the underwriting market, I think one of the things that will need to be thought about as we move forward is how those changes mesh with this program. I think those will have to be worked out as we move through that process, and obviously those two do interact. I think that how that evolves moving forward will certainly impact this, and we'll need to consider that as we move along.
So Mr. Senator Chair, so thank you, sir. So I think Senator Sharon's comments about evaluation and watching this process as it goes through and how it evolves, I think, will be important, because I think today it appears that there, you know, could be some level of cherry picking, if you will, and just have healthy individuals in this program, and that those that had pre-existing conditions in IMCHA. But as we move forward, we actually could continue to fill the roles of this defined benefit program with people who had pre-existing conditions before, which then impact the underwriting criteria. And maybe the participation, as you said, the enthusiastic participation of health insurers today may not be so in the future if they start to pick up more people that don't fit their underwriting criteria of today. I guess that was more of a statement, but it's just my thoughts.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator Hayden, and I think you're asking a good question. I think it's possible that if those federal criteria do come in place, it could be that the private insurance markets would be very severely affected. I know that one of the things that happened with the requirement of the federal law that insurance for children, for example, could not be denied for any what's happened as a result of that is there's no longer insurance available for children in the state of Minnesota. And I think other states as well. So I think those changes will have a dramatic effect, and if they come to pass, then, as Commissioner Light says, that we would have to adjust that and see what happens, because we can't fully predict what the response will be. But I do share your concern that when you do those things, it does have an effect on insurance plans and providers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's why I think that Senator Marty's bill, the one that I'm supporting within the Minnesota Health Plan, might be the way.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm not sure that solves the problem in my view. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. That's all what we're discussing is, you know, as you develop, whether it's the Affordable Health Care Act or this proposal, it's in increments. And so if, depending on what happens with that, everybody must have health insurance and all of the other components of the Affordable Health Care Act will influence that decision about children. So, you know, it is a moving target that in its pieces might hurt the insurance companies more than when it is moved in completion. But my question is this. Regardless of whether we have the Affordable Health Care Act at the federal level or this continues, because under either scenario, I anticipate that there will be, if we keep this operating as it is with what I think of as a cherry-picking process for the insurance companies and and that MCHA has a higher burden. It's a high deductible program, and right now we're just assessing that against the plans in order to cover the alternative. Or if it's the Affordable Health Care Act, where the state has to make a contribution to add the additional people into the program, there will be a state obligation either way. And I'm very concerned about a decision we made last session to eliminate the Minnesota care tax. So I'm also asking that as you process this along, that we understand the implications under either scenario of our long-term state obligations, whether it's in MCHA or the Affordable Health Care Act, the matching dollars, and that all of us be open to the possibility that revenue stream may continue to be important to us in the future, and we may have to delay or extend, and I'll be watching that very closely. I think all of us would like to see, especially the medical community, if we aren't going to tax all services, why would we do them? But we will have obligations here, and we may not have a revenue stream to pay for them. So please include that in your analysis and study of the implications of what we're doing.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Seeing none, we will journal early today. Members, next week I anticipate we will start hearing bills. We have gotten a few. I'm sorry, next week we may not be meeting because of our break. Is that correct? So whenever the next meeting we have, I anticipate having hearings on bills that have been submitted for consideration. So thank you, and appreciate your testimony, our witnesses, and we are adjourned.